Good afternoon. Let's resume our meeting from this morning. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I. The date is April 2nd, 2008, and the time is 1:38 p.m. The Title Board this afternoon consists of the following. My name is Bill Hobbs, Deputy Secretary of State. Appearing for Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. To my right is Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, who's here on behalf of Attorney General John Southers. And to my left is Dan Carton, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is the designee this afternoon for the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike. Also to my far left is Maury Kanizer, Deputy Attorney General, who represents the Title Board. And to my far right is Ceci Gomez of the Secretary of State's office. Let's go ahead and turn to the agenda. The first item is a motion for rehearing concerning 2007-2008 number 73, criminal conduct by businesses liability. This is a motion for rehearing filed on behalf of Joseph B. Blake by Doug Friednash. Mr. Friednash, if we could hear from you. We have the benefit of your written motion for rehearing, but if you'd like to summarize that for the board.
That'd be great. Good afternoon. Doug Friednash appearing on behalf of Fairfield Woods and the objector, Joe Blake. The first part of this discussion concerns the fact that we believe this violates a single subject requirement, insofar that it relates to more than one subject and has two separate and distinct purposes that are not connected to each other. With respect to the different subjects, the measure dramatically expands the criminal liability of businesses to executive officials, and not just the expansion in terms of the parties, but expansion in terms of crimes. It impacts health regulations and any other duty imposed by governmental entities. It also allows a private right of action for all residents against executive officials and businesses. In this context, it's not just an extension and expansion. It is a whole new area of civil liability that creates problems within itself, and we'll talk about that later with regard to Initiative 75 as well. The resident is not defined in the measure. The damages to governmental entities aren't defined in this measure. And the private right of action applies to all residents without regard to whether or not they have suffered actual injury as a result of it. The funds to the governmental entities are all exempt from all revenue and spending limits. I believe that voters are going to be surprised to know the extent to which this law applies. I think they'll be surprised to know that, as I read this, the damages could go to the federal government, and that Colorado residents are the only ones that could bring these claims that could be that far-reaching. I think voters will be surprised to know that the federal government or other governmental entities could collect punitive damages from businesses and executive officials, as well as compensatory damages that aren't defined in the measure. I think voters will be surprised to know that if a frivolous case moves forward on behalf of the federal government or state, local government, that while a successful plaintiff may recover fees, a successful defendant will not be entitled to such fees. And I know, obviously, there's a Rule 11 procedure for frivolous and groundless cases. I can tell you, as a practicing litigant, I don't recall a single case that I've been involved with or recall in recent memory where that's actually been awarded. And very specifically, this creates a incentive to file lawsuits. The title is unclear, confusing, misleading. It's misleading as to the liability of criminal conduct by business entities, which is the title and subject of this matter. In essence, it not only creates a new standard of conduct covering executive officials' liability, that could be statutory, regulatory, and health standards, and so forth. It extends and expands. I think voters will be surprised to learn, and it's unclear by the very measure that undocumented illegal aliens can bring a case. The aspect of the governmental entity is particularly perplexing. It's unclear where money goes, what happens when you have overlapping regulations or laws amongst different governmental entities. If you look at the definition, just by way of example only, of governmental entity that's involved in the Initiative 76, the Just Cause Initiative, you could see how far-reaching the proponents of that measure deem a governmental entity to go. It's the same proponents that are advancing this measure. Governmental entities could be federal, state, local government agencies, can be boards, commissions, it could be enterprises, it could be school districts, special districts. It's really pretty far-reaching, and this does not address a lot of things. It's unclear and confusing as to how this will apply. The title refers to civil damages, when in fact we're dealing with compensatory or punitive. It doesn't indicate what type of civil damages are involved. I think voters will be surprised to know they're punitive damages. It's unclear what compensatory damages these governmental entities will have suffered as a result of these. And it's, I think voters will be surprised to learn that these actions will actually result in competition between governmental entities and truly injured parties for legitimate claims. In other words, that a governmental entity that may have filed a case first may get a judgment which could either A, bankrupt the company or an executive official, or B, they will get damages collected before a private party that was injured, or limit that ability to collect damages. The title's unclear, confusing, and misleading because it refers to the fact that a successful plaintiff gets the fees, which obviously encourages frivolous cases, whereas a successful defendant does not. It doesn't specify what happens to the fact the successful business or executive official. In fact, this creates an uneven playing field that voters aren't aware of. It's misleading in that context, and that should have been addressed. It's misleading in the context that it tells voters that you have an affirmative defense if you provide the Attorney General all facts that are known to you, but it doesn't say prior to being charged. And I think that's important because it leaves the impression among a voter who probably doesn't understand what affirmative defense actually means, other than it's a defense to the charge itself, that as long as they come clean, they don't need to worry about this. In fact, the fact that it has to happen before, I think, is an essential element of this measure. There is the title is unclear as to, and misleading, in a sense it does not define who an executive official is. A common definition of executive that you'd find in dictionary would refer to somebody who's an administrative or managerial, some type of supervisory authority, when in fact this case, in this measure, deals with a much more narrow group of executives and executive officials. I think that will be misleading to the voter. I think they will be surprised to know that it doesn't apply to a supervisor or particular executives of companies, as the concept or term executive would suggest. And I think that's a fundamental problem as well. I think the failure to include the mention of the exemption of damages when it applies to this many potential governmental entities is an essential problem with this measure. And I think it also is confusing in the term of whether or not the government needs to be a party to a lawsuit. And let me tell you why I think that's important, and it's confusing in terms of how this works together. You have parties who bring a lawsuit on behalf of the government. They're then going to potentially enter into settlement negotiations with a defendant without the knowledge, consent of a governmental entity. I think that's truly problematic. And then finally, I think to the extent it talks about bringing, the title talks about bringing, or the measure talks about bringing civil action for such criminal conduct in the concept, it says allowing an award of damages in civil action to the governmental entity that imposed the civil duty is misleading to the extent they talk about those damages for such criminal conduct, which it does in the line above that. The problem is this. This goes beyond criminal conduct. We are actually criminalizing new conduct. That is a byproduct of this measure. It is not criminal conduct to violate a health standard, by way of example, but under this measure, it is, and it misleads the voter into believing a much more narrow structure of this measure as it pertains to civil measures, which is not accurate. So in view of that, we ask that this measure be stricken and returned. And I'm happy to take any questions, or I'll leave it there. I know you've been fully briefed on this from prior discussions on this and the related measures. So appreciate your time.
Questions for Mr. Friednash? I guess not.
Thank
you very much.
Sure.
Mr. Gruskin, would you like to respond on behalf of proponents?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Gruskin. I'm with Isaacson Rosenbaum and represent the proponents. I think what you've heard is a very thoughtful and forceful discussion of the political arguments that will surface during a campaign, if there is one on this. But primarily, the arguments you've heard are policy-based arguments that suggest that this isn't the way to go. Well, that may be true. It may not be, but that's not really, as you know, the board's issue. The motion itself has a fair amount of political rhetoric in it, talking about races to the courthouse and the fact that there are going to be undocumented aliens bringing lawsuits all over the state of Colorado. Some of the arguments that you heard are retreads of arguments you've already heard, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them. But I do think we ought to talk about what the motion appears to be saying about the title, since that's really this board's concern. As I said, the argument about whether or not the single subject statement is correct is one that's been discussed before. I'm not going to go there with you now. The question is asked, where does the money go? Where do the damages go? But frankly, this is a statute. It's not a constitutional amendment. It doesn't have to spell out everything. And the General Assembly can certainly supplement if it's required. But that doesn't go to the ballot title. And frankly, if the measure doesn't say it, then the ballot title doesn't have to project it. I'm going to skip a couple of issues and talk about the suggestion that there be a definition of an executive official. I don't really share Mr. Friednash's concern that somehow executive official is a commonly understood term that has a exceedingly narrow application. He may be right, but I also don't think this is a central feature of the measure, that being that the particular individuals who may be subject to this measure. Now, frankly, if the board wants to include a definition of executive official, I'm fine with that, but I don't think that it is probably all that central, and it, to the extent that it is a phrase that will give people cause to read further, they can certainly do that. I think this board generally is reluctant just to say that a measure defines a term and not provide a lot of detail. The question of whether or not there ought to be some reference to the Tabor aspects, the exemption from revenue and spending limits, because there's a great number of government entities, I'm not really sure why that's relevant. To the extent that the question is whether or not there will be any significant number of lawsuits and whether they will be successful and whether there will be damages and whether then that would be apportioned out among a wide variety of public entities are all preconditions to worrying about Tabor. And so I think the board has correctly decided that issue in the past. Ms. Friednash asks whether or not government needs to be a party to a lawsuit. How are you going to have settlement discussions without the government in the room? And frankly, seems to me That may be something the proponents could have, and in Mr. Friedensch's view, should have addressed, but they didn't. And the question is whether or not the title reflects what they did address. So inserting that kind of conjecture into the title would be inappropriate. There's often been a discussion of whether or not you are criminalizing civil responsibilities. And I come back to the base statute, which talks about whether or not a person or an entity is guilty of an offense. I'm having the toughest time understanding how you can take that phraseology and say that it applies to civil duties or fiduciary duties or anything of the sort. I don't think there's going to be voter surprise, coming back to his single subject argument. This issue about the damages to the federal government, I suppose, is interesting, albeit to the extent that this initiative builds off existing state statute. Existing state statute talks about being guilty of particular offenses, and there's no suggestion in current law that somehow federal laws are incorporated in a state statute that provides for the existing criminal remedy. And so it seems to me to be, as I say, a political argument, maybe an interesting one, but not something that the title board needs to concern itself with. In terms of the payment of attorney's fees, well, there's nothing in here that undoes or countermands or in any way undermines Rule 11 or the existing statute on frivolous lawsuits. And so I know the argument has been made publicly about how defendants won't be able to recoup their legal fees for frivolous lawsuits, but there's nothing in here that specifically prohibits them from pursuing the remedies they currently have. If there was, then that should be in the title, but because there isn't, I don't see how you get to where Mr. Friedensch is. Now, he raises two issues, and I like to think of myself as a generally reasonable person. I suggest to you that the point that he raises about compensatory and punitive damages is one that is probably a reasonable. And we certainly have no problem including that language here. Again, I think that the reference to damages is clear, but I think that the fact that there are compensatory or punitive damages, and to the extent that that is specifically couched in the disjunctive rather than the conjunctive, probably makes it worthwhile for the title board to include. And it doesn't lengthen the title by any significant amount and allows, frankly, let me be candid about this. Obviously, much of the positioning that happens in front of you is positioning for the Supreme Court. Let's take away one of the arguments that there's something wrong with the title by including three more words. The discussion of whether or not the affirmative defense should be specific, that all information has to be divulged prior to charging, I don't see that sub-element of the affirmative defense, which is a sub-element of the criminal piece of this, which is, frankly, a sub-element of the whole, to be a central feature. But I know that you've set and revised more titles than I've ever been involved in, and I would leave that to you. We don't have any objection to it. I don't know that it's pivotal, but I, again, in terms of removing arrows from Mr. Blake's quiver, I'm all for that. So if that's something that the board feels is important, I'm fine with that. I don't think that there are any other, major arguments that are raised here. I'd be happy to respond to any that you've seen that I've failed to highlight.
Mr. Domenico?
I think I've already expressed, my concern with this structure of both extending liability to individuals and creating this private right of action of a sort. So I don't need to get back into that. But I do have two questions. One, I think I agree with you on that this doesn't criminalize civil conduct. But I just want to make sure we're all in agreement on why that is, because it is a little bit confusing the way it's written in the new 1.5, right, says an executive official is guilty of an offense if the conduct constituting the offense consists of an omission to discharge a specific duty, etc., imposed on the business entity by law. And the confusion there is if you just read that, there's multiple uses of offense, right? And in 1.5 it says, is guilty of an offense if the conduct constituting the offense consists of an omission to discharge a specific duty. Reading just that, it seems to me, Mr. Friednash's reading is plausible in that this is creating an offense if you've omitted to discharge a specific duty or affirmative performance imposed on the business entity by law. The only way to read it the way you are suggesting to read it, which is that it already basically has to be an offense, is to read sort of the second offense in 1.5 as referring back to Section 1, right? That it's the executive official is guilty of his own offense only if the business has engaged in conduct that consists of an offense under subsection 1. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. So my second question then is, I really don't understand how this private suit is supposed to work. There's two kinds of private rights of action outside of tort law, as far as I understand. There's sort of quitom stuff where a individual sues on behalf of the government, where there's damage to the government entity and a individual is authorized to sue, and then there's some kind of splitting up of the money they get. Then there's others where there's kind of a statutory duty created, and if a defendant has violated that duty, there's a debate sometimes if it's not clearly stated, where individuals who are harmed by the failure to live up to that duty have the right to sue or they don't. And in this case, there's this kind of a missing step. It's not a quitom where it's not clearly that, where any individual has the right to sue if they discover damage to the government. But it's also not clear to me that this would be more typical private right of action where the person doing the suing would have to show damage themselves, a typical standing type inquiry. And I'm just curious how you see this fitting in, because if in fact it's neither of those, it's some new type of suit, then I do see a problem, a standing problem, that you've created a new type of standing that is kind of a big deal. Maybe it's really just a constitutional problem and not our problem if you try to create a new standing. But I'm just curious how you see the private right of action actually working.
Well, I defer to the eloquence of the Attorney General in his recent brief to the Supreme Court on a predecessor measure, where he argued that this was more of the quitom variety and that it was entirely consistent with that manner of lawsuit, albeit not carbon copy, and that this is a mechanism that is known, accepted, and understood in terms of the vindication of public rights by private citizens. And so it seems to me that I would not be accurate if I said to you that it was anything but that. That it was. It's not as I think I said. It's not a carbon copy, but it is very much in that mold.
Okay. Thanks.
Any questions for Mr. Grusin? Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Friednash, do you have any further? Okay.
First, with respect to the Mr. Gruskin pointed out that the measure could just simply say, the title could just simply say that they're creating a definition of executive official. This doesn't say that. In terms of criminalizing a civil statute, you know, I would tell you that I would read closely 1.5, paragraph 5A, and then what's the point of the statute in the context of 18.1607 if you're not creating new offenses, first of all. Second, the ability to collect damages is based on these violations of these new governmental duties. And I think, assuming he's right that it's not intended to create new offenses, this thing's confusing at best. But I think much differently. This is a little different than the prior version you read in 57, because they've carved out a very specific subsection dealing with executive officials and what constitutes, you know, a violation of that duty. And I think it applies to all governmental regulations on every level imaginable. And that's just what it does. And otherwise, why are you collecting damages based on that? And what's the point of the statute if I'm wrong? With respect to the payment of attorney's fees, having a one-sided view of this, I think permitting individuals to bring a civil action to be awarded attorney's fees and costs and not stating the same sentence that, you know, that no such right exists for defendant, a successful defendant, is a problem. And it doesn't paint the clear picture of what this does. And again, if we're just relying on Rule 11, we don't need to put that in there at all. Otherwise, it creates a very uneven playing field. Rule 11, or the frivolous and groundless, fixatious statute in Title 13.
Well, obviously, the measure creates an uneven playing field. But
absolutely.
So shouldn't the title reflect the uneven playing field?
I think it absolutely should. And businesses and executive officials and primarily the voters should know that they don't get, while they're at risk for punitive and compensatory damages, they don't have a right to recover their fees in defending this case successfully. And I think that's a problem. And also, in terms of the qui tam, I need to investigate this further, but I'm pretty certain when you bring a qui tam action that the United States attorney has the first right to kind of co-opt that case. And I will research it further, and you may want to as well, but I'm not certain a qui tam case evolves. And one of the attorneys in my office has done a lot of this, has handled a lot of these cases, but I'm pretty sure that when a qui tam, you have the person who's complaining of the qui tam, who was affected by it, and then I think the U.S. attorney has a right to step in. It might even be the Colorado Attorney General as well has a right to step in and kind of take over that case. So it is a different type of animal. And I think there is a step missing. And I think it is confusing and misleading. And obviously, I think it will raise some constitutional considerations. And it's nice to sit here consistently and be able to say, you know, that's not our job, but, you know, ultimately, people deal with it. I understand what the rules are of the game, but I think it's part of the confusing, misleading nature. Thank you.
Thank you. Discussion by the board?
Well, I've already, you know, I think voted against this the first time, because I really do think that there are two subjects here creating this new type of civil action, and then also making individuals liable where previously only businesses were. I don't think the title statement of the subject gives much hint about what's going on. And, you know, the fact that this is a weird hybrid sort of qui tam feeds into that a little bit, that it's not the sort of thing that is generally going to be understood as contained within the concept of liability for criminal conduct by business entities. It's really a something else, and it obviously it's related to that concept, but I think it's really sort of surprising, and unless you raise the level of generality of the subject really high, which is what we've done here, in which case you could fit almost anything under it, I think it's too distinct, too surprising, too much of a risk that people will say, well, yeah, I'd like to hold executives liable when the businesses that they run violate the law, but do I also want to start creating this entirely new form of lawsuit to deal with it? And that's something that seems to me really voters should be given a choice between the two. Most of the rest of the arguments I don't think I'm persuaded by. I do think the title could be improved a little bit, but I'm still where I was, and the more I think about the form of the private cause of action, the more, frankly, I'm confused by it, and the more convinced I am that if you're going to do something like that, it's got to be pretty clear that that's what's going on and can't be tacked on to something else like this. So I would grant the motion on that basis.
Mr. Carton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, just appreciate the arguments and the discussions put forth by Mr. Friednash and Mr. Gruskin here. Briefly, and perhaps repeating myself somewhat from prior hearings on this measure and similar measures, I think that I'd acknowledge that there may be a couple of main purposes in this measure, one being imposing criminal liability on an executive official for actions of the business entity. I go back, way back, to the fact that I think we're dealing with a statute, 18-1606, that as currently stands is a different type of criminal statute. But I think that the amendment that is made to that statute in 73 is consistent, the language in 1.5 is consistent with 1A, and that there's congruity there, and I think that a court would interpret it that way. I think the second main purpose may be to give a civil cause of action against executive officials or the business entity, and I think Mr. Domenico has ably stated his concerns with that perhaps being a separate subject, but I feel as though those two purposes are interrelated, the imposition of criminal liability and the civil action, that they're not incongruous, and I don't see any hidden or surreptitiousness arising from those particular provisions. And so I would still adhere to my initial position that this measure contains a single subject. As far as the title goes, just again very briefly addressing some of Mr. Friednash's points, I don't think that the fact that the ballot title does not currently define a governmental entity is fatal to the title, given the relevant precedent that we have to rely on. And I think I agree with Mr. Gruskin's points in response to this particular argument. I think that the fact that the title is silent as to what Mr. Friednash has argued is that the measure misleads the voter into believing that a party can disclose all facts known to him or her, the Attorney General, at any time. Sure. Mr. Friednash argues that the measure misleads the voter into believing that a party can disclose all facts known to him or her to the Attorney General at any time in order to utilize this as an affirmative defense. In fact, the disclosure must occur prior to being charged. The title is silent as to this provision and would mislead voters into believing that they could disclose information at any time and not be subject to liability. I don't think adding that particular disclosure to the title is necessary. I don't think that the fact that the title currently doesn't contain the provision that damage awards are paid to the governmental entity and then exempted from revenue and spending limits is necessarily a component that should be included in this particular ballot title. Mr. Friedenesch has argued that the title fails to define who falls within the purview of executive official. And again, for based on some of the discussion here, I don't think the title necessarily needs to address that particular point. And I guess I would be open to talking about amending the title language with the three words that Mr. Gruskin has posited here in the clause talking about awarding civil damages, allowing an award of compensatory or punitive damages in the civil action. But I think the fact that it says allowing an award of damages in the civil action, the non-inclusion of compensatory or punitive, again, I'm not sold that that is misleading or otherwise is necessary to the title. And then my final point, again, to the title, and I think Mr. Friedenesch argued that the language permitting an individual who brings a successful civil action to be awarded attorney's fees and costs doesn't disclose that if the other side prevails, they don't get their fees and costs. I think that was basically your argument, that should be included in the title, that type of disclosure. And again, I don't feel that's a necessary component of the title language. And so I would be open to granting the motion to the extent of adding or modifying the title language, but not as to the single subject issue.
Well, I'll just briefly summarize my position. I do still think that the measure is a single subject. I think what it is about is business liability or accountability of businesses for misconduct, criminal misconduct, I believe. And I think the expression of the single subject in the title, although we certainly have wrestled with it quite a bit, but I think it's a fair expression of the single subject in describing it as liability for criminal conduct by business entities. You know, and I recognize that there's two different means by which the measure proposes to address liability by business entity, and one is extending liability to executive officials, and the other is to provide for a private right of action. But it seems to me that a measure can have multiple ways of addressing a subject, and it just doesn't strike me that those means are separate and distinct purposes that have no connection to each other. I think that a number of the issues raised in the motion for rehearing concerning either surprising provisions of the measure or unclear provisions of the measure, assuming that's true, I don't think they go to single subject issues. I think even if and using attorney's fees as an example, that may be a surprising policy choice. It may be an unequal treatment of litigants. I believe we've seen measures like that before. I think Tabor may be an example of that. But it's a policy choice that if it's a surprising policy choice, it does not make the measure surreptitious or in violation of the single subject rule. And I feel pretty much the same way about provisions that may be unclear. For example, the I believe the definition of executive official, for example. In any event, it's not uncommon for measures to have unanswered questions, and again, I don't look at those normally as single subject issues unless a measure is so unclear that we're unable to determine what it is about, and I don't think this measure rises to that level. So I still believe the measure is a single subject. I'm certainly open to amending the title to in the manner that Mr. Gruskin suggested, but other than that, I would probably vote to deny the motion for rehearing with that one exception being the change to the title.
I just,
Mr. Domenico.
I'm sure it's futile, but just to respond a little bit, obviously the two things that are going on are not unrelated. They are tied together by the same motivation and the same basic purpose. I completely acknowledge that. But the closest case that I can think of is the public trust case. I mean, in that case, clearly everything that was going on was pointed in the same direction, served all the same purpose. But the Supreme Court said, no, this public trust thing, while it's related clearly to what you're trying to do here, is a separate subject that is sort of not clear from everything else you're doing. Wouldn't strike someone when they hear, hey, there's a measure on the ballot about, in this case, liability for criminal conduct by business entities. In this case, there the Supreme Court threw it out because there was this public trust doctrine hidden inside the measure. Here, we're creating a novel new form of private right of action that may be essentially or very similar to Keaton, but this is really something new that has no real direct precedent in the law, and it's not clear from the title or the measure itself exactly how that'll work. And to me, that's very similar. In fact, goes beyond the public trust doctrine. I voted in favor of that measure. And maybe I would vote in favor of this one if the Supreme Court hadn't come out that way. But I really think that just because these are related to each other, and just because they serve the purpose of trying to punish criminal conduct by business entities, doesn't resolve the single subject question. I think we have to go a little bit beyond that, and so I'm still not convinced, and that's the concern I have. I'm not going to make a motion, though, unless I've won anybody over. So.
And I do appreciate what you have to say. I think you've legitimately raised and described an issue, and I don't mean to imply that it's open and shut. I think the public rights and water case is of course, one of the best to always go back to. I think in my mind a couple of things that I use to not reach the same result is it seems to me the public rights and water case involved a broader subject, a very broad subject, and I think the court was saying just because everything fits under that broad subject, that doesn't mean there's not a violation of single subject. Here, I think there may be a difference of opinion. I think you could view if the topic here is business liability, that could be an awfully broad subject, but on the other hand, it's just a single statutory section out of many thousands, and I tend to view that as a narrower subject than
because it incorporates by reference every other part of the law that imposes a criminal liability on a business. I mean, it really reaches quite a bit.
And I think that's a fair comment. I do think that, you know, the fact that there is a novel right of action that's created here is something that needs to be taken seriously. I come out on that believing that it's important that the title clearly identify and make sure that the voters are aware of that in the title. I don't come out from that issue thinking that it's a single subject violation, but I don't know. It's just two different ways of looking at a difficult issue, I think. If there's no other discussion, I guess, let's see if there's support for changing the titles as suggested by Mr. Gruskin. Mr. Carton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Procedurally, I'm not sure what the next step is, but if it would be appropriate, perhaps Ceci could insert the amendment that Mr. Gruskin has proposed and either vote on that particular amendment or vote on the entire motion.
I guess my suggestion might be just to go ahead and move a change to the title, and if it's adopted, then I think a subsequent motion would be to grant the motion for rehearing to the extent the board has amended the titles and deny the motion in all other respects, if that works.
I would move that change.
I have a slight variation on it if you want to.
Okay. So this
actually is just adding something. So
on the same issue.
Same basic issue, yeah.
Okay. Well, this did you make the motion?
Yeah, I just did, but it wasn't seconded. So I'll withdraw that motion.
It's now
this is a discussion.
It's now just a suggestion by Mr. Carton to insert compensatory or punitive before the word damages on line 7, Mr. Domenico. It's a suggestion of Mr. Carton to insert the words compensatory or punitive before the word damages on line 7. Mr. Domenico?
My suggestion is to leave that as suggested by Mr. Carton, but to clarify what's going on a little bit, I think, in the previous line, I guess it's actually on line 5 on the screen, would be after bring, insert a civil and delete an, and then delete for civil damages, that's now on line 6. I think that is closer to the actual way the measure reads and may resolve. I'd delete damages too.
Delete damages.
Yeah. I think that's pretty close to what the measure says. And because I don't think it ever references civil damages. It references civil action and then compensatory or punitive damages. So with those two changes, I think it's a pretty good reflection of what's going on.
I like that. I think that clause then refers to being allowing civil action, and the next clause then says that it follows up on that. It's allowing an award of damages in the civil action. So I think they work together well. Is there any comment from proponents or opponents? Okay. I'll go ahead and, well, Mr. Carton, do you want to move that? Is that?
Sure, I'll move both of those changes.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other motions?
Mr. Chair, I would move to, and if, so, shot. I would move to grant the motion for rehearing to the extent changes have been made to the ballot title and to deny the motion in all other respects.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. That completes action on number 73. The time is 2:28 p.m. The next agenda item is 2007-2008, number 74, liability of business entities and their executive officials, criminal liability. This is before us on a motion for rehearing. Mr. Friednesch, if you would like to present the motion for rehearing.
Yeah, real briefly. I'm just, with respect to my comments on the last one that pertain to the criminal portion of this, I'd really just reincorporate that and rely on the motion itself. I don't think we need much discussion on this one. The challenge is basically that the title is misleading, confusing, and unclear. I would say note that the aspect of the actual subject is much different in this than what we saw in 73 and 57. And my concerns over, greater concerns, were not just extending but expanding the aspect of liability. But with that, unless there's any questions, I'll stop there.
I don't think so, although I guess my role with versus Mr. Domenico's are kind of opposite here, whereas I think I was a no vote last time, but I believe my concern was that the title did not clearly express the single subject. But in any event, I don't think you're raising that as an issue, as far as I recall. I think you're satisfied with that expression of the single subject. You disagree with respect to the fact that it is a single subject?
Yeah, you know, I thought we did raise that in the...
Okay.
I need to go back through the motion. But I thought we did raise that. Perhaps I didn't.
Well, no, I think you did. Now that I see page 2, the first full paragraph, I think that when you say the first single subject statement is different from what was
right.
accepted in 57 and 73... So I think you have
right.
identified that. Okay. Any questions for Mr. Friednesch? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gruskin, would you like to respond to the motion for rehearing? Okay, no comments from Mr. Gruskin. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Discussion by the board.
I think this was one that sort of was a compromise between various positions, and I would have preferred, I think, that we get rid of the in connection therewith language in this one, but because I just think it would be clearer. That said, I don't think it's misleading. I think it does state the single subject, and I share some of the concerns that the petition or the motion raised about implying that it's already existing law that executive officials have liability, but I don't think I agree that it necessarily implies that. I think it's clear enough. So I'm still content with it, if not, even though I think it could be improved.
You know, and I think it's, although I probably would still grant the motion for rehearing on the issue of the expression of the single subject, it's a relatively minor point, especially with this particular measure. I think, Mr. Domenico, you're correct. I think this is kind of a compromise. I don't think it's misleading. I don't want to imply that. I'm more concerned about the possible precedent for future measures where we don't state, don't clearly express the single subject as a subject. and I don't know that I'm articulating that very well, but when we start to describe what a measure does instead of what it is, what it is about, then that starts to concern me as a matter of precedent. In this particular measure, I think it's not misleading. I'm just concerned about where that leads us. But so I probably still on the other side of that. But again, it's not a huge issue for me. Any other discussion? Is there a motion?
I'd move to deny the motion for a hearing on proposed initiative 2007-2008, number 74.
I second the motion.
If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. No. That motion carries 2-1. That concludes action on number 74, and the time is 2:34 p.m. The next agenda item is 2007-2008, number 75, criminal conduct by businesses, civil liability. This is before us on a motion for rehearing. Mr. Friednesh.
Thank you. For the record, Doug Friednesh, appearing on behalf of Fairfield Woods and the objector, Joe Blake. I just want to put it in context, you know, to extent, again, I'm not trying to regurgitate things I've already said, so to the extent I've already said them, I start to restate them, I apologize. This one's a little more difficult to deal with in and of itself, even though it's, I think, the object of 75 and 76 were largely probably insurance purposes in case the Supreme Court decides 57 or 62 are create single subject problems. But there were initial concerns expressed at the initial hearing with respect to this measure that voters could be surprised by what it does and that it has a confusing nature of the measure and that it's a close call. The title concerns civil liability for criminal conduct by business entities. And I just want to restate, I think, what Mr. Domenico commented was there's real potential for surprise that voters thinking they're voting on civil liability for criminal conduct by business entities, they're surprised that they're also making new individuals subject to this liability. And, you know, I've already told you the various elements of why I think this is unclear and confusing and misleading. My concerns are the same with respect to this one. But I really truly think, and I think I just want to kind of amplify something we've already discussed about the type of new type of private right of action this creates. And even though this just deals with the civil context, you're dealing with it as a separate and distinct measure. I mean, this is theoretically standalone, and 18-1606 is in its current form. I think there's really some disconnect to the voter and signers of petition of what this truly does and how it works and what that private right of action looks like. And I really would ask that you really, not that you haven't seriously considered these already, but just think about it in its own context, if this makes sense. Because it is real difficult, I think, to kind of ascertain what this really truly gets at and the type of conduct that really is at issue and what a prima facie case would actually look like in this context. And I assume, you know, you can make the same changes you made last time, obviously, to the extent it clarifies the measure, we support it. But ultimately, it has the same fatal problems that the prior one had, and maybe even some additional ones just because it's a separate and distinct measure to the criminal conduct that is dealt with in a separate and distinct measure or under current law that's not included here. It makes reference to criminal conduct by business entities. This is just strictly a civil liability statute that I think doesn't just deal with criminal conduct, and I think that's the problem with the subject of this to begin with. So unless there's questions, I think we've probably talked and kind of fleshed out a lot of these issues. I'm happy to address anything.
Okay, Mr. Carton.
Just a quick question, just for my clarification, I appreciate it. Mr. Friednesh, are you arguing that your motion, one of the arguments is there's a single subject issue. Based on what you just said, is it your argument not that there are are you arguing that because of surprise and the fact that it's confusing and misleading that the board should not set a title for it, or that based on those grounds and decisions such as 55, since there's an element of surprise for voters, that it can there's a single subject issue with the measure? Well, is that the argument?
I think there's both. I mean, I think you have type of surprise and concern you had in 55. I think it's possible to discern exactly what the single subject is. Concern criminal conduct by business entities. So I think there's really two separate and distinct issues. One is whether it violates a single subject, whether you can kind of discern what it does, how it applies and who it applies to, scope of which it applies to new rights. And second, the language itself, the title is analogous to the argument I've already made in 73, which is that it's misleading, confusing, complete in its context. And I'm happy to kind of go through those specific things. But
for example, in 73, and this really simplifies, oversimplifies it, but you know, generally the argument was that you have a measure that extends criminal liability and that creates a private right of action, and that those are subjects that there are issues under the single subject requirement because of that secondary private right of action. What do you see as the multiple subjects aside from the issues arising from the text being confusing or misleading that you allege, or hidden outcomes or speculative results? What are the multiple?
Sure. Let's start with that.
Yeah.
The title says concerning civil liability for criminal conduct by business entities. It suggests it's already a law. Civil liability for criminal conduct by business entities already law. It's not. That would be one subject, right? That's how we start this. I think voters are going to be surprised by the fact that beyond voting for that subject, they're also voting on making new individuals subject to liability, executive officials, when in fact they're really two. They're going to be surprised to learn they're expanding the type of liability that I think this measure does. I know you haven't bought the argument ever that I've made with respect to the governmental exemptions for damages, but I think that's a separate subject. And I think it's that context. We're not just talking about expanding for officials, but also creating, you know, this new component, new private right of action. That last piece. I think that's the single subject problem.
Thank you.
And then the misleadings, you know, the same things I talked about before, you know, the language of it, the affirmative duties, the damage portion of it. I can go through them. They're, I think, outlined already, but they're the same ones I just argued on 73 as it pertains to this piece.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Mr. Gruskin, would you like to respond?
Mark Ruskin for the proponents, hearing in Groundhog Day number 25. if you haven't heard an argument, it's not because Mr. Friednesh and I haven't made them over and over again. I'm not going to do that to you anymore. I do think that the topic here is pretty darn narrow. It's rooted to specific conduct addressed by existing statute, and I think it is something the voters can get their arms around. I would suggest that the changes made to number 73 could be parallel here, and unfortunately I wasn't omniscient enough to know what Mr. Domenico was going to say, but nonetheless, proposed provision that I think could serve as the basis for change. It's the inclusion of compensatory or punitive, as you did here. And I suppose if you made a parallel change, it would happen, in addition to this one, it would happen on lines 2 and 3, where it says allowing a Colorado resident to bring a civil action against a business entity or its executive officials, rather than an action for civil given the repeated focus on civil liability and civil actions, I think that that changes. So in the name of civility, I'll sit down.
Can I ask you a couple of questions that have to do with all of these, or maybe it's just one? And I probably should have asked it before, because it's really, I think, related more to the prior versions of these where that involved the criminal liability and Mr. Friednash's argument that this extended to new types of behavior. I think after our first hearing on this, I read a newspaper article characterizing what happened and was sort of surprised to see that it was somehow supposed to address the Nacho situation. And I was struggling to figure out how this would resolve anybody's anger at Joe Nacho without doing what Mr. Friednash, what you and I seem to agree it doesn't do, but what Mr. Friednash was feared that this would do, which is make fraud and other things that are normally civil issues crimes, right? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
I read the same article, and I was probably as curious as you were about the representations made, either by the people speaking in the article or the reporters reporting what the people had said. It seems to me that the Joe Nacho situation is different because it occurs under federal law, because it was a proceeding that was specific to federal securities statutes. I suppose that it would be analogous if there was a state security statute that had been violated, that Mr. Nacho was aware of the violation and aware of the duty imposed by that security statute and did nothing.
Right. And so the how this relates to this part of it then is, I don't understand if this is basically a QI-TOM provision. What's the damage that the plaintiff is going to be recovering on behalf of the state? In that situation, there's a duty owed to the public who's buying stock not to lie about what is going on in your company. I don't understand I really am confused how these cases are going to work under this and under 73, how these cases are going to work, because it seems to me that there's already a private right of action if you've suffered damage. If the state has suffered damage, there's already a public right of action. The state can bring some kind of suit. But in those situations, I don't see... This seems to create a new right of action without creating a new substantive provision that would give rise to the suit, and I just am very confused about how it would work.
Well, I think that the way it would work would be that if a specific legal duty had been violated, the plaintiff, in that instance, would be authorized to seek either compensatory or punitive damages, or presumably could seek both. The court could award either. If there was no compensatory damage to be awarded, then obviously the award would be zero. There might be the potential for punitive damages based upon the nature of the offense and the discretion of the court.
So that's my question. If there's no damage in the sense that there's no compensatory aspect to it, are courts just going to get to say, we just want to punish you, or how will they, or are we going to have to wait and figure that out through clarifying legislation and court cases, what punitive damages mean and how they're calculated? Or it's hard for me to conceptualize these suits without anyone actually having suffered damage, without anyone actually having to show someone suffered damage, whether themselves or the state.
Well, I guess my response would be, in any civil action that seeks compensatory or punitive damages, the court can find that there was no basis for any compensatory damages, or can award a dollar, but then make a suitable award of punitive damages, depending upon the egregiousness of the conduct and all the other contributing factors. So that's not really that different from anything under existing law in terms of the way the civil courts operate. The difference is that this is triggered by behavior that violates Colorado state criminal statutes under a series of conditions relative to either the business entity or the business executive official.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions? Any response, Mr. Friedenash? Okay. Board discussion?
Well,
Mr. Tan.
I think I was on the fence on this one last time, but voted for it. But I'm struggling with it this time even more. To address, I think, what Mr. Carton was raising with Mr. Friedenash, it seems to me this has a similar, it's not quite as obvious to me that this is two subjects, but it's basically the same concern, which is you're not only creating a new type of lawsuit, which this one clearly does and is more upfront about that, but you are also subjecting a new class of people to liability under that. Now, the difference between this one and 73 is basically that those people are only subject to the civil liability, and they're not also being subjected to criminal liability, and which is important, was important to me when I voted against 73. But it's still, I'm not sure if that's a pure single subject issue or more along the lines of what we've been talking about with some of the others, of a surprising thing that's sort of hard to pull out of the measure, both hard to pull out of the measure and hard to capture in a single subject that conveys what you're doing. This one, I think, is better, but I'm really struggling to see how. Well, I guess what I'm saying is I understand pretty much all of Mr. Friedenash's concerns. Only one of them really strikes me as a concern that would give me reason to vote against this here at the title board, which is this concern that this idea that it's not just business entities being subjected to civil liability, but also individuals is, while again related, is something of a surprise and a hidden purpose in the measure. Not in the sense that it's intentionally hidden or intentionally misleading, but just that by its nature it gets kind of overwhelmed by the rest of it. So that's the single subject concern I have, and I'd like to listen to responses because I'm not sure how I'm going to vote.
Very briefly, and I appreciate that follow-up. I still feel as though there's a single subject. I think the single subject is stated adequately in the title that we set, 475. And I think just as a matter of perhaps editorial comment and thinking in response to you, Mr. Domenico, I think a number of these measures that have come up here in the past month or so before the board that I've sat on, and I think it's kind of a result of 55 and maybe some extent 17 recently, we seem to get into these discussions of surprise and surreptitiousness and potential unforeseen outcomes and what the voters may not know that they should know or would be surprised by. And all I can boil it down to is that I think that personally I may take more of a strict kind of adherence to the text of 140.106.5 and those decisions that have us look at congruity and a central theme and interrelated purposes. And I personally am not one I'm a little reluctant to step into the land of surprise and surreptitiousness on a number of these measures. Although I think that they're legitimate arguments, I think it's a legitimate discussion. I'm not ready to base my own decision where there isn't really more of a concrete, old school, single subject issue involved on the surprise and surreptitiousness and confusion and those types of things when that, to me, is not crystal clear as well. And so, again, I appreciate this kind of this ongoing dialogue in this area, but I would stick with my initial decision on 75 and would be amenable to amending the title to 75 to sync it up with I think 73.
I think that's kind of where I am as well. You know, it is interesting some of the discussions we're having about surprise and surreptitiousness because I think that I look at, and sort of going back and thinking about how to look at this, I think 140-106.5 characterizes the issue of surreptitiousness or surprise, you know, as guides to, as kind of legislative findings about when. Or how to determine if there's a single subject violation. In other words, and I don't know how to say this very clearly, but they're not mere surprise is not a single subject violation. Again, as I indicated before, I think you can make surprising policy choices. Rather, it's sort of you approach that from the reverse side. Is if you sense that there may be more than one subject, then it's helpful to know why the single subject rule exists as a guide to interpreting the prohibition against multiple subjects. And the legislature said in 106.5 that understand that in referring this measure to the people to prohibit multiple subjects, here are the practices we intended to prevent. And like I say, it's kind of a legislative declaration issue that helps guide us in determining violations of single subject. And I don't think I'm describing it very well, but I think I have to start with a belief that there's possibly more than one subject. And for this one, I'm not really there right now, so I don't know how to think about surprise or surreptitiousness. But I probably not. Mr. Domenico is usually way ahead of me, but I've probably not caught up with his thinking on this yet. But I would still, in that respect, would deny the motion for rehearing, although I would like to incorporate the changes to the titles that that we've talked about, and I think Ms. Gomez has marked them on the title as it appears on the screen. And if that's accurate, I guess I will move those changes.
Second.
Is there any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. I guess I'll go ahead and move that the board grant the motion for rehearing to the extent that the board has amended the titles and deny the motion for rehearing in all other respects.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And that concludes action on number 75. The time is 3:00. The next agenda item is 2007-2008 number 76, just cause for employee discharge or suspension. This measure is before us on a motion for rehearing. Mr. Friednash.
Doug Friednash, Fairfield Woods, appearing on behalf of the objector. As it may seem like Groundhog Day for you, but I feel like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. So let me briefly start by referring and incorporating the motion we filed for rehearing and trying to move this along accordingly. I think part of the problem is, with respect to the single subject, is that it is very, very, very difficult to discern exactly what the single subject of this measure is. The title discusses concerning a requirement that an employer first establish just cause before discharging or suspending an employee. The actual purpose appears to be to repeal the Employment at Will Doctrine. And it creates a new standard and defines the just cause standard in this initiative. Ultimately, though, what it really does is it creates almost a dual standard of how employers and employees are treated, and it's not captured by the title. But on one hand, you have a measure that applies to full-time employees who have worked for a private employer for 6 or more consecutive months and has more than 20 employees. They seem to be covered, not seem, they are covered by a different standard than everyone else. Everyone else is exempted out. And when I say everyone else, what we're talking about are, you know, less than a full-time employee, whatever that is, less than 6 months, fewer than 20 employees. They have a different standard. I'm not sure what all their rights are, if they have a right to contract or not. If you have if you're a labor union with a collective bargaining agreement that deals with just cause, then you're under a different standard. If you're the government, you're under a different standard. And if you're a nonprofit with fewer than 1,000 employees, you're exempted under this. So it creates truly a different set of rules that apply to different people. Voters, I believe, are going to be surprised by how it affects certain people, or whether it affects them or not, or how it works, and whether you have a right to contract, and the fact that it will ultimately treat similarly situated people differently. And that, I think, is the basic single subject problem that this deals with. And I think it's more ambiguous as a result than what you dealt with in 62. With respect to the title, you know, again, I think the subject's confusing. Somebody pointed out that it doesn't leave discuss the action taken. I'll get to that in a second. It's unclear what this does and who it applies to by reading the title. I think it misleads voters as to who it applies to. It may mislead voters into thinking it applies to many more employers or employees than it really does. And it doesn't convey to voters that they're taking action on creating a prohibition. It suggests that just cause standard is already Colorado law. It suggests that just cause standard, I think, is a question of fairness as opposed to a particular employment standard. It is unclear and confusing in the sense that it does create a dual standard and who those people that it applies to really are. You don't know that from what you're voting on. And it's unclear and confusing, and this is not just as a political statement, but a constitutional problem as well. If it, in fact, violates your right to contract, that is a substantive, you know, there are obviously title initiatives and measures that have been dealt with the court, dealing with changes in substantive, fundamental, procedural, and constitutional law that are treated as separate subjects. And also, to the extent they're not clearly articulated, they have been found to be prohibited as being misleading, confusing, unclear. And I think it is unclear as to who can contract, whether you can contract or not, and who can contract, and how this actually fits. So I just chose those points to amplify what's already in the motion. I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions for Mr. Friednesch?
If, I guess, I can't quite tell if your argument about the right to contract is just related to the fact that the title's misleading, or are you arguing that that's a separate subject? And then, okay, so you...
Both.
So my question is, would you, if this clearly, if the measure clearly said employees and employers may not enter into agreements that undermine the just cause requirement or something like that, something that clearly stated you can't contract around this, would that, I guess my question is, is your argument that that's unconstitutional because it violates the right to contract?
Yes.
Okay. So then it seems to me that if you're right about that, that we shouldn't really worry about it, because since it's silent on that point, one of the fundamental canons of construction is not to read a law as violating the Constitution if you can avoid it. And since it's silent, you would read it to not impose an unconstitutional requirement. And so then I'm not worried about it, since it's not in there.
If I can respond.
Sure.
Briefly, I think when you deal with constitutional issues in a constitutional manner, which this is, we're not something that voters can just go fix. You have to read this, and I think just because it isn't dealt with doesn't mean it's not impact. It doesn't have that effect. And I understand your terms in terms of construction, but I think that is the effect. I think it says, look, you can, if you're already covered by a bona fide collective bargaining agreement, which contains a provision that requires just cause for discharging or suspension from employment, it's okay. But otherwise, you can't contract. And I think that is what this is. It doesn't have to have that language in here to basically state you can't contract. It's saying if you're a full-time employee, you've worked for a company for six or more months, and you have 20 or more employees, that this is the law. And we're not telling people, by the way, that we're repealing the employment at will doctrine for those same people. That's hidden here. So that is the law. For everyone else, you know, you have different sets of standards. But clearly, those people can't contract. Everyone else probably can. I think it's implicit in what this actually says.
Wait, who can contract and who can't, as you interpret it?
As I interpret it, if you're full-time, you employers cannot contract with full-time employees who worked for six or more months for them, and where they have 20 or more employees. You can't contract with employees. Everyone else can. You can contract with, you know, part-time employees, full-time employees, and they're less. And for all businesses that have under 20 employees, you can contract. But voters are going to be surprised by how this fits together. They're going to be surprised by the way this measure works, which I think is virtually impossible to discern exactly how it will work and what it exactly means and who it applies to. But that's the basic fundamental problem with this. Before, you had a measure that applied to all employers and all employees. Obviously, yes, and the unions weren't too thrilled with the fact that it impacted their collective bargaining agreements. The government employees didn't have their due process rights, but it creates, you know, different standards for different people that voters will be confused about. Again, the title says employer must first establish just cause before discharging or suspending an employee. That's the title. Not certain employers, or not the fact that we're prohibiting a certain action. We're not conveying that to the voter. I think these are fundamental problems with this measure. Title.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Grigson.
Mark Ruskin, appearing for the proponents. I'm sensitive to the arguments made by Mr. Friednesch. I think they're thoughtful and deserve substantive response, albeit nothing that you haven't already heard. I guess I would say this. 2 years ago, the voters considered a constitutional amendment to put minimum wage in the Colorado Constitution. Did that deprive employers of the right to contract? I don't think so. It obviously set a standard, but it didn't entirely undermine the right to contract. Mr. Friednesch talks about how there will be a dual standard. Well, frankly, thanks to his insights, pointed out that there already is a dual standard. When he told me a month ago that there was an issue, at least an implied issue, with the civil service system. You don't have an at-will employment relationship with when someone's working for state or local government. There is a process. There has to be documentation and the like. So what this measure does is it sets up, as opposed to constitutionalizing at will, it simply sets forth certain classes of people that are not that are subject to the just cause standard. And I think it's fairly clear. I think the board spent a long time on this title, and I think that it has reflected the thought process that that's been discussed at the previous hearing. I would suggest this. As I say, I take Mr. Friednesch seriously when makes his single subject and his misleading arguments, and I think that there are ways to improve this title. And I'd like to suggest to you that there are some things that could be done that might throw light on provisions that will ultimately be deemed to be central to the measure. So we're going to, if I could, a proposed set of revisions. If you don't mind, I'd walk you through them, unless you need want to hit the single subject issues first. But I think that the single subject issue has been pretty thoroughly debated. Let me just run through these. Mr. Friednesch argued that this should be clear that it's got about full-time employees, and I think that's a good comment. I think that otherwise the suggestion is that somebody who mows your lawn once. Is subject to it. So I think his comment's a good one and a thoughtful one. He also suggests that there's an exception in the measure that isn't addressed in the title for employees covered by a collective bargaining agreement. I think that's a good comment. I think he's right. I think that the title ought to reflect, because it has other exceptions, that one as well. Now, I'm not positive that the place that I put it or the way that I put it is necessarily the best way to do it, because there's the first three exceptions apply to employers, and then this last one applies to employees to whom this provision doesn't apply because they have their own just cause, like the bargaining agreement. And I toyed with other ways of making a standalone provision or talking about the definition of employee to mimic the text, but I was concerned about brevity, brevity issues, and put it in there at least to reflect my agreement with Mr. Friedenash that the title can address that, and hoping that it prompts conversation with the board and Mr. Friedenash to see whether or not that's the best way. Finally, the motion, while it only indirectly addresses it, does talk about the remedies issue. And in looking at the remedies section of the title, that one clause beginning with the word requiring currently states that, or would lead voters to believe that there's a requirement that there be a remedy even if there's not a violation of the standards in the measure. And that, I don't think was, I know it's not the intent of the measure. It's not what the measure says. The measure is quite explicit that the remedy is conditioned upon, actually what the exact text says, quote, if the discharge or suspension is held to have been wrongful under the provisions of this section, the court shall, at its discretion, award the employee. And it just seems to me that when you embraced using the word requiring, I think my original word was authorizing, you, as a connecting point to the earlier clause, made it appear to voters that the mere filing of a civil action results in a remedy. I think that probably is misleading. And it may not be that this is the optimal language, but I do think that it that it reflects the finding that is the necessary precursor to an award. And I've taken out the language relative to the court's discretion because I think the court always has discretion. That's not a central feature of the measure. And in any event, the final subclause that talks about or any combination thereof makes it pretty clear that the court has the opportunity to get involved in the formulation of the remedy. So those are comments I'd make, and I'd ask you to find it a single subject as you have before, and then express my appreciation to Mr. Friedenash and his client for the substantive comments on the accuracy of the title, and hope the board will make some appropriate decisions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Gruskin? Thank you. Mr. Friedenash, the changes suggested by Mr. Gruskin, are they acceptable to you?
Yeah, the full-time, I think, is a great addition to this. I think it helps quite a bit. The change and employees are covered by collective, I think that's a good change. The last one, I'm having a hard time with, just because to fully capture what they're trying to do here, I think in the text, you almost need to lift that language verbatim. They talk about wrongful in the context of this section. So that one troubles me a little. I need to give it some thought, but certainly the first two, I think, are definitely a step in the right direction.
Okay. Thank
and
you.
You know, again, real quickly, I know you spent a lot of time in last initial meeting trying to deal with the first sentence. I mean, I think that obviously is still something that has to be addressed. So.
Well, in the spirit of Groundhog Day, it occurs to me that this may be an example of the same old issue of how much do we put in the expression of the single subject. I think Mr. Friedenash, your point's well taken in a way that what we have right now doesn't really tell you what the current law is. I mean, if it's just concerning a requirement, it could be repealing that requirement that it already exists, or it could be creating a new requirement, and we haven't clearly said that. And I think it goes back to the discussions that we've been having, is that there's a temptation, I think, to expect the single subject clause to accomplish too much. That we really, and we've done this a lot, we try to not just say what the measure is about, but to signal to the reader what it's doing about that subject. And then we get into this dilemma of, if we're going to talk about what it's doing, then wouldn't it be easier, and in using this as an example, to just say an amendment to the Constitution requiring that an employer first establish just cause, and that resolves the problem. And as we start to go down that road, then, but we start to pack it with more things that seem to be important, like it's, well, it's just full-time employees. And I, that's probably relating to my concern that to the extent that we expect that first clause to be almost sufficient for the reader to know what the major thing is about this measure, I that just still troubles me. To me, it would be better, and I, this is the old traditional approach, but to say a simple subject that something is about, and then more clearly in the next clause saying the major thing that it is doing about that subject. And it adds a lot of words. This is not a clear example that I'd like to use, but it would, because it would be a fair amount of repetition, but it would be concerning, you know, just cause for something, and in connection there with requiring that an employer first establish just cause, you know, and build in whatever is really significant, like full-time employees or whatever, because we've got a lot more, because there we're saying what it is doing as opposed to simply what it is about. And you know, I last time I was okay with this because I think it's kind of implied when we say concerning a requirement that an employer first establish just cause. I think the reader probably can by implication know that it's requiring just cause. But, you know, the more I think about it, I don't know that that's entirely an inference that everybody will get. And that kind of troubles me now. I think Mr. Domenico would want a simpler approach of just requiring just cause. I think that's simple. It's understandable. It gets us away, I think, from an expression of a subject. In other words, what the measure is about. And I think it leads to that need to say more when you're depending so much on that first clause to tell the reader what's going on. But I don't know. It's still an issue. It gets cumbersome and legalistic and repetitious. But this is a little bit of a dilemma, in that I agree with you, Mr. Friedenash. It's kind of, what about that requirement? And we didn't say.
Yeah, I mean, I think I voted against this for that very reason. I think we need to go one direction or the other. Either go back to just saying an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning, I would probably avoid using just cause just because I think it's a little bit loaded to some extent, and just say concerning cause for discharging or suspending employees, and in connection therewith, and then go into requiring and get pretty specific about the requirement. Or personally, I think it'd be okay just saying an amendment to the Colorado Constitution requiring that an employer first establish just cause and do what we've got there, but make it clear in that first sentence that this measure is doing the requiring. I think this is actually a very good candidate for that approach, because really in this one, all of the stuff that comes later is related to, is in connection with that requirement. It's all sort of explanation, exceptions, definitions about that requirement. There, I think you're right, will be cases where that won't work. This case, I think it actually would work pretty well to do it that way. But I agree. I would rather, if we're not going to do that, I'd rather go back and just say something very simple in the opening and then put the requiring as a verb after the in connection therewith.
And I can live with the simpler approach on this one. I think this is a little bit like number 74, where, on the sake of principle, I'd prefer to go the other way. But this is one that is not as troublesome as some, because I think we can fairly simply say simply what it's doing. And I think this is not one that would bother me so much. It's more of the practice that it could lead to. But if But if we recognize that this one is not so problematic because it's not an example of one, we're talking about packing a lot of detail into that opening clause, then it's certainly something I can live with. And I think since it does strike me as a lot like, I think, number 74, and I was in the minority on that, I don't want to make a huge issue about that other than the practice that, the general practice that I've described. Mr. Gruskin?
Chairman, I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but I'll let Mr. Freeness speak for himself, but I have been whispering with him. And my takeaway is that the shorter, briefer clause that the board originally used would be acceptable to the proponents. And I agree with Mr. Domenico that rather than having the in connection therewith and going into a definition, you could certainly say something like requiring an employer to establish and document the just cause used to justify an employee's discharge or suspension. Something like that. It's a clause that currently exists on 5 and 6, and it'd be somewhat modified. But I never really thought I'd get to the point where I had a philosophy about single subject things. But I mean, I do think that it is, it's like, it's a headline. It's not supposed to be the whole story. It's supposed to be enough to take your attention as a voter and allow you to be able to identify the measure. And then the rest of the title is backfill, if you will, to provide the necessary detail so that there is enough amplification that people know pretty much what the whole measure is. But I think that first clause is just about kind of saying, grabbing voters by the lapels, if you will, and saying, this is what I'm about. And so, you know, the briefer statement and referring to cause rather than just cause, I think works. As I said, I'm not going to put it.
And yes, if it does certainly matter a lot to me if you guys are agreeing on the approach. Either way.
I think the way Mr. DeMenico first said it made a lot of sense. Concerning, I don't remember exactly what he said, but taking out the term just cause, because I think that is loaded, and saying cause, concerning, I don't even recall exactly how you said it.
Yeah, well,
I read it back from the record, or you probably know, but that seemed to make more sense.
Yeah, there are two ways I think we could improve this, and it sounds like you guys are pushing in one direction. And my idea, if we went in that direction, would be after concerning, to simply say concerning cause for the discharge or suspension of employees, and that's it. And then in connection therewith, and then we'd have to add a sentence in there or a clause in there stating that in connection therewith, requiring that an employer first establish, Mr. Gruskin, basically what he said first, that require that an employer first establish and document just cause before discharging or suspending a full-time employee, and then basically go into the rest of it. If we were going to go in that direction, that's what I would suggest.
And I'd certainly be happy about that, of course, but I don't know. Mr. Carton, do you have a preference on which approach we take?
No, I've got nothing to add. If the proponents are supportive of it, then...
What if it just said concerning cause for employee discharge or suspension?
Sounds good.
Okay, I'll move that we make that the single subject statement.
I'll second that.
So then it would delete everything between there and the in connection therewith.
Would some of that end up getting...
Yeah, I'd probably cut it because we'll... a requirement all the way through an employee on line 3.
Do you want to just go ahead and let's do this all together, but since these are interconnected?
However.
Let's go ahead and see then what the next clause would look like.
Sure. So my suggestion would then be paste that in there and we can fix the grammar. So it would be in connection there with requiring. That an employer first establish just cause before discharging or suspending a full-time employee.
Hyphenate the full-time?
Yeah. And then, the rest of the suggestions that Mr. Gruskin provided us with. I think adding the part about collective bargaining agreement is a good idea. I had one small revision to the part about what the court is supposed to do.
Should we maybe take this? Is this?
You'd verbalized it before, but I think you can save yourself about 15 words. End of line 6 and on line 7. Write written documentation, blah, blah, blah. You could say requiring that an employer first establish and document.
Right, and then get rid of that.
Good.
I think that, yeah, I'd support that. So delete lines requiring an the line beginning requiring an employer.
Deleted.
All the way, yeah, through line 7. All the way to the end of line 7. And then adding in line 3 after establish the words and document. Correct. So did you want to stop there? And
I think those changes are all interrelated, and you made the first motion, which I seconded, but if that's okay with you, then we'll just include all of those changes in that motion.
Yeah, that's my motion.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Mr. Gruskin?
Can I just, the way it reads, requiring that an employer first establish and document just cause or discharging, I mean, you haven't really said, as you had in the earlier title, that it's just cause for the discharge and the suspension. I suppose your single subject statement talks about cause for discharge.
Yeah, we got into this business about, didn't we, about before, this had something to do with the idea of this being a prohibition versus a something else, I forget.
In sort of the word first.
Before, yeah. I mean, well, first is actually in the measure, but you could, I think, yeah, I mean, I understand your concern.
Mine is not a complaint about the title. I just want to make sure that the word before was the right.
Yeah, well, when you combine it with document, the document part's not really
right. Part
of the first requirement.
Well, presumably you would have to document it. I guess to the extent that subsection 3 is in the past tense, who has been discharged.
I guess
you would technically, you would have the potential as an employer establish just cause, do the firing, and then...
I think the only way I can think about to address that concern is to sort of rewrite that to say something like requiring that... An employer establish, you could say sort of closer to what the language of the measure says, prohibiting an employer from discharging or suspending a full-time employee unless the employer has established and documented, or unless the employer can establish just cause, establish and document just cause, something like that. I mean, there is this concept in the way it's written that the establishment of just cause has to be first, but I don't really know. That's not really important, I don't think. I mean,
employer establish and document just cause.
Yeah. 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 So it would read requiring an employer to establish and document just cause, and you could get rid of before just in case that's causing a concern again in line 4 and say in order to discharge or suspend a full-time employee. Oh, so for the discharge. Yeah, I think that's good. And that actually reflects the language in the subject clause better, too. Well, then we need to get rid of that in line 3. I think we actually voted on that previous motion, so do we?
Didn't quite finish the vote.
Okay. I mean, we could either do that or a new motion, so it's up to you.
Okay. Well, I'll just, with that variation, I'll just restart the vote. All those in favor of those changes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion is adopted 3-0. Other changes to the titles?
I'll go. There's two more that Mr. Gruskin suggested that were at least partly based on Mr. Friednash's recommendations, which I think are good, to add a mention of the collective bargaining agreement on line 10, I guess it is. So it would delete an and before governmental entities and insert and employees who are covered by a collective bargaining agreement that requires just cause for discharge or suspension. I know there was a mention that there might be some concern because you go from exempting business entities to exempting employees, but I think that grammar conveys what's going on pretty well.
Is that your motion?
Yeah, I move that we make that change.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Mr. Domenico?
There's one more change that Mr. Gruskin suggested that I think is a good one. I had one suggestion which would be that's related to that change, which would be currently it reads on line 12 on the screen, requiring the court, and then it goes on to the language that's being changed. I would just change it doesn't actually require the court to do anything, it allows it to. I would just change that to allowing. And then make the changes Mr. Gruskin recommended, which would be to change from the to a court. Um, and then after court insert that fines an employee's discharge or suspension to be wrongful. And then delete in its discretion. One related thing to consider while we're considering this is Mr. Friednesch, I think, said he had some concern about just wrongful might be misinterpreted as overly broad. I'm not sure that concerns me all that much, but you could fix that concern, I think, by getting rid of wrongful to say just something like a court that finds an employee's discharge or suspension to violate this section. Instead of wrongful, would I think be accurate and resolve that if it's a concern worth resolving.
I suggest let's go ahead and do that. Mr. Friednesch is nodding; he's okay with that.
Okay, so yeah, instead of wrongful, I think I said to be in violation of this section.
Violation of this section.
Oh yeah, since we're setting the title, yeah, of the
amendment.
Amendment is probably the way to say it, or yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then delete that comma right after that. Those are all the thoughts I have.
So that would read, allowing a court that finds an employee's discharge or suspension to be a violation of this amendment.
In violation, actually, it says.
To be in violation of this amendment, to award reinstatement, etc. Let's just consider that editorial unless there's objection.
No.
Then, Mr. Domenico, is that your motion?
Yeah, I move that we make those changes on 13 and 14.
I'll second that. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other changes to the titles? Not, is there a motion to grant the motion for rehearing to the extent that the board has amended the titles and deny the motion in all other respects?
I so move.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Do I need to read this into the record? It's all been done on the screen. If there's looks like Mr. Gruskin and Mr. Friednesch are okay with not doing that. Thank you. Okay, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 76. The time is 3:43 p.m. And I believe that completes our agenda. And we are adjourned. Thank you.
See, we really are like the French Revolution, right? We went all crazy there for a while, and now we're back. The reactionaries are in charge. Yeah. And Napoleon's coming to take over. And